Hello and welcome to the Sense Making in a Changing World podcast. I'm Morag Gamble. Join me each week in conversation with leading permaculture and ecological educators, thinkers, activists, authors, designers, and practitioners to explore the kind of thinking we need to navigate a positive and regenerative way forward to myceliate possibilities and share ideas of what a thriving one planet way of life could look like. My guests offer voices of clarity and common sense. This month, we're creating a special Urban Agriculture series in collaboration with Urban Agriculture Month, organised by Sustain Australia. In this episode, I'm speaking with Bjorn Low, creator and director of the amazing Edible Garden City project in Singapore, an urban community farming and edible gardening phenomenon transforming Singaporeans' relationship with food and growing food. Edible Garden City is a proud recipient of the 2021 President's Award for the Environment. Bjorn started the Edible Garden City project around a decade ago and has been championing the Grow Your Own Food movement for social, ecological and health benefits. Almost all of Singapore's food is imported, and there's been little opportunity for generations to be connected with food growing. Bjorn's own transformation from digital specialist to a permaculture farmer and then educator has been profound. This really is an amazing story of what's possible in highly urban communities. Edible Garden City is so inspirational. Let me begin first by acknowledging that I'm recording this episode from my hand-built solar-powered studio here on beautiful Gubbi Gubbi country. I'm surrounded here by my beautiful permaculture design gardens in a permaculture eco-village. The Sense Making in a Changing World podcast is a project of the Permaculture Education Institute. We teach permaculture design, teachers, and livelihood skills online to people on six continents, who in turn localize and enrich this knowledge and find appropriate ways to apply the planet care ethics of earth care, people care, and fair share wherever they are. So before we jump in, I'd like to invite you to subscribe to Sense Making in a Changing World podcast on your favorite app. And please do leave us a five-star review and a lovely comment, because it honestly really does help the bots to find this little podcast. Okay, let's turn the conversation now to Bjorn Low. Welcome to the show, Bjorn. It's really lovely to have your company here today as part of this special urban agriculture series. You're from Singapore. And I understand that Singapore is, I've never actually been to Singapore, but I understand it's a highly urbanized city-state, multiple islands, that has a history of importing most of its food, as I understand. So can you tell us a little bit about maybe a bit of the context of the Edible Garden City project in that Singaporean frame?
Thank you for inviting me onto this show. And yes, I'm from Singapore, born and bred. And I think when I was growing up in Singapore, there was very little opportunity for me to engage with food growing or agriculture. And this was in the 80s. And during that time, Singapore was going through a rapid industrial transformation, where a lot of the spaces that were in the past small family farms were then, you know, converted into residential, high-rise residential, and sort of industrial application. And so the opportunity when I was young to just drive past or walk past a farm was very limited. I think this is again something that many Singaporeans of my age experience whilst growing up. And this, I think, this transformation during that time was very essential for Singapore, as you know, we don't have any natural resources at all. So we have to import our water, for example, from Malaysia. The rhetoric, or at least the goals by the then government, was to increase, you know, our GDP capacity through other forms of human resourcing, manufacturing, and then financial services, and now biomedical science. And so agriculture and food production became very, very secondary in its importance, because the idea that if we have a good GDP, we can always command imports of food at a good price, right? And because we don't have land, we don't have resources, it is better to do it that way. So that has then gone on for, 20, 20 plus 30 years. And today, Singapore imports 90% of our food from 170 countries. But even with this kind of crazy numbers, I think the strategy around ensuring food security is still very robust in Singapore. For example, the government do put in various measures on stockpiling of various important grains, for example, rice. So that is actually a manner where rice would come in. It will be stockpiled for a specific period of time before it's then released into the markets. This kind of ensures that there's always that latent supply of grains or important food stuff that could tide us through maybe a global shortage, for example, or price hike to control prices around food. But of course, I think over this very long period of time where agriculture has played a very secondary role in Singapore, there are other issues that have come to surface, which is then the very limited understanding of Singaporeans and, you know, the entire food system. This has caused then, you know, a big culture around waste. And even though we import 90% of our food, today we throw away 700,000 tons of food per annum. So this disparity is something that we are trying to kind of identify and help, you know, address some of these challenges. And I think when I got back to Singapore after working on many farms around Europe, seeing different models of food production, smallholding farms and different methods, very encouraged to then look in the rural areas. I mean, Singapore, though a small island, do have a very small countryside. And I started looking there for, you know, just a 1 acre plot to run a market garden, which was what I've learned in the past. But I think the accessibility to agriculture land is then tied with a lot of barriers. You can't go and get an acre plot and then start growing food and then selling them. You need to be an established enterprise with insurance amount of millions of dollars. And so the barriers of entry for any new farmer coming into the space was very limited. And for me, you know, after seeing that, I was very discouraged. I was a bit disappointed. And walking around the city, I was like, hey, there's this grass patch between these two buildings. Perhaps getting something started here, growing produce for the community and selling it to the restaurants could be a model that could happen. And that was the idea that started. So urban agriculture was never what I intended to do. It kind of came out because of a need, of a restriction, and just being a bit more creative in how I approached the way to create an agriculture business in Singapore.
Can I just take a step back? Because that's a wonderful story of a long arc that you've just taken us. And I wonder, how did you actually get to that point of realizing the importance and value of the food system and agriculture and go from probably not an agriculture background to going and visiting farms around Europe? Like, what was the shift that happened in you?
I did spend a bit of time in the UK, and it was I was in a corporate job, and I was just feeling very disillusioned, and actually I chanced upon or came across a concept called permaculture, and it's like, oh wow, I don't have to work in a corporate job and I can survive, you know, grow my own food, produce my own electricity and all of that. And I dragged my partner to permaculture conversions course, and that sort of changed my outlook on what was possible, that you don't have to live in that rat race. With that spark of interest, got me to quit my job and then went to work on farms, which then led me to a biodynamic agriculture college, which I then got a diploma in biodynamic agriculture, which then again opened up a whole new paradigm of approaches to food growing and sustainability and closed loop farming. All of these were, you know, the sort of stepping stones and building blocks towards how Edible Garden City was conceived, around some of these philosophies and ideas, around self-sustainability. And I think trying to fit that idea and concept into a city like Singapore was one of the biggest challenge, because 80% of Singaporeans, or probably more, live in very, we call it vertical colonies, where, you know, small spaces, and whilst there are a lot of green spaces around, they are very inaccessible in that sense to grow your own food. So so the idea about activating spaces in the urban setting was, again, based a lot on some of these initial concepts like permaculture and biodynamic agriculture.
I think it's really interesting, like you're saying, this sort of the vertical colonies, and, you know, Singapore's known as like one of the greenest cities in the world and a lot of green space, but like you're saying, it's inaccessible. So this idea of the commons and the access to spaces in which you could actually have input and the possibility to grow food. So can you tell us a little bit about, well, one, what is the Edible Garden City program, and what does it look like in its multiple dimensions? And maybe also weave in a bit of the thread of how the Singaporean government is shifted its gaze to thinking about, you know, setting goals for actually growing more food in the city and supporting people to do that.
Going back and understanding how the space and you know, the nation is governed, it is always a top-down approach where you know, you have authoritarian and push. So they have done a great job in greening up the spaces, because that was always used as a neoliberal tool to attract investments into Singapore. But I think the National Parks Board has done a great job in terms of you know, embracing community gardening as one of their main push. Today, there are 1,000+ registered community gardens in Singapore under the National Parks Board in the public housing estates, which are run by residents. So in that sense, the greening and, you know, the participation of community is very robust and well developed, but again, these are predominantly driven from the top down. So there's a high level of bureaucracy in terms of how community gardens are pushed out and who can participate and who can't, and of course the limitation of space. Even though there's a lot of space around, you know, so these constraints are still evident. And I think generally greenery in Singapore is very manicured, is very manufactured, is well planned, and is well maintained, but then by not but is not maintained by the community or Singaporeans. We have a big reliance on foreign migrant workers, and many of these landscape workers are from countries such as Bangladesh, India, who do the hard labor of maintaining the landscape. This, I think, causes a sort of a split, or at least as a Singaporean growing up, it's very hard to feel in touch with the greenery, because we are so We do not participate in that greening of Singapore, which I think over time the government has tried to increase participation through the community gardening programs. But I think the generations prior have already lost that at least that touch with the landscape. So that those are some of the challenges that I've at least seen within the last 10 years. And I think the idea of getting people to reconnect or to be part of that process, the greening process, is through growing their own food, because there's always a outcome and there's always a reward when you do harvest your own produce that people can look forward to. And it's an easy segue into then that greater connection with nature.
And so in terms of this growing your own movement that you're championing in Singapore, where are people doing this? How is this unfolding? Where are people finding space, and how are you supporting people finding space in the projects that you're setting up?
So of course, there are mechanisms to help people start a community garden. I think the government has done a great job in providing those resources, and if in some ways access to community gardens, while we perform a much different role within that ecosystem, and we try and find underutilized spaces within Singapore to activate. So a lot of our early work was in rooftops, underutilized rooftops that, for example, rooftop car parks. In Singapore, it's really hot and humid all year round. And the idea of parking on a rooftop car park is shunned by many. So you can always see on a rooftop car park that there's typically no cars there. And the first pop-up we did in 2015 was on top of a 30,000 square feet rooftop car park. And we activated the space using urban agriculture, invited community to participate. And this sort of placemaking type initiative actually brought people into a space it's not used, and then to engage and participate in food growing. And the idea is perhaps in the future, this could be allocated into allotment plots that people can adopt. These kind of space activation programs allow people to at least start to get their hands dirty, start to learn about food growing, start to learn about different systems such as aquaponics or soil-based growing or even hydroponics if they so wish. But it's really then a space where people come together with similar ideology and, you know, come and brainstorm about how to, you know, design the space, how to create programs, for example, as well to engage an even wider population or audience.
There's lots of things I want to ask you about, but I'm going to go in one direction. One direction that I wanted to ask you about is this concept of soil-based growing in a highly urbanized environment, when the tendency that you see is often towards a lot of vertical growing and hydroponic growing as opposed to the soil-based. So from a permaculture perspective, for me, I'm always tending towards the soil. I'd love for you to just to share a bit about, you know, when you do have such an urbanized environment, what that looks like, how people are responding to the different concepts and what you're noticing.
Yeah, I think this is a great question. I think in my own journey, of course, I am very much kind of aligned to soil-based growing. And again, with a lot of rooftops, propensity of bringing up soil onto the rooftop do come into challenges, for example, structural loading, if you're bringing up soil, can be an issue. And a lot of times the soil in Singapore is, most of the time, is imported. So again, then it becomes a question for us, depending on the space that we are developing, what is the best systems that can go up. But looking on another view in Singapore, because of the building regulations, so developers, when they develop a new plot of land, for example, with high-rise building, There is a policy which requires them to measure the amount of greenery that they have taken away and then put that back into the building. This policy is called the green plot ratio. So if a developer is to build high rises, he has to then green it. So that actually brought a whole new industry into Singapore around vertical gardening. So vertical green walls, and this then changed the way rooftops have been designed. So down the line, the newer buildings, for example, would have rooftop gardens already planned in because they are trying to achieve this green plot ratio in order to develop the space. And what this has done is then the structural loading and all that will be already considered. The drainage will be considered, and the soil will be brought up. Where the soil comes from, we don't know. We know that they are more or less imported from Malaysia, and then backfilled into the rooftop gardens, for example. But I think Singapore and Malaysia are pretty close, and they do have the same soil type, which is quite heavy yellow clay. So when we do start to engage with these already designed rooftop gardens, a lot of our work is then to convert these spaces from an ornamental garden into a food producing space. And this is really a low hanging fruit for us because the gardens are there, they spend massive amount of money to put that up. It's just a changing of mindset of the building management people and then implementing it by changing the crops. And we tend to use a lot of sustainable methods to convert the spaces. So one of the earlier instances, we did a lot of green manuring at the start. We brought in a lot of compost, and these are composts that have been manufactured in Singapore or made in Singapore using horticulture trimmings. You know, it's like the municipal compost you get in Australia. It's not well composted down. It's still a bit woody, and it does, if you dig it in, it rots nitrogen. So we try to solve that by growing a first crop of legumes and then always digging that in so that we can plant the main crop post that. And this has worked quite well as a sort of process for us, and also has a great educational element within that. And what we saw also during the time of sowing these cover crops or green manure was that it always invited or has a latent sort of aphids within them, and then there will be a massive aphid boom. But over the 3 to 4 months period that we're managing this green manure crop, you see the ladybirds come, and they come in droves. So quickly, you can see that the ecosystem or the biodiversity increase over a short period of time through application of green manure within these spaces, and then the bird life improves and all of that. So it's really been quite encouraging through that process. And what we then did was also started to look at various techniques of growing within the soil-based agriculture system in Singapore. One challenge with Singapore, as with many other tropical countries, is the crazy torrential rains we get every day. The rain sizes, when it drops, it's big, right? And the thing is, if you have an open bit, like an open bit that the soil is exposed, when the rain comes, it washes away the topsoil immediately. So in Singapore or in a lot of tropical areas, how they do agriculture is they build greenhouses. And that really puzzled me at the start. You know, I've seen lots of polytunnels and greenhouses, and they were normally used to keep the heat in so that you can extend your growing season. So I was, just scratching my head. Why are there so many greenhouses and poly, plastic houses in Asia where they're growing crops? And that is to really stop the rain from hitting the open field that's being cultivated. And so when we approach some of these challenges and not building these greenhouses, food forests came to mind, and the implementation of a multi-layered growing system allows the sort of bigger trees to break the rainfall, and then with the cover crop, and then your second story, your third story of food producing plants was something that was very easy to implement in Singapore. And for rooftop gardens, I think that creates also a good aesthetic with a diversity of plants, because we are very familiar with landscape gardens. So this provide an alternative to landscape gardens as well, but is food producing. But the challenge then with applications of these food forests within the urban context is that typically the food that is produced, because we have to then use native plants, produce that are unfamiliar to most people in Singapore. Because a lot of the eating habits today in Singapore is quite global. We demand strawberries all times of the year, even though you can't grow strawberries in Singapore. So people are not familiar with a lot of these native food that grows and thrive within the environment. So then there needs to be quite a bit of work in encouraging people to use some of these herbs or vegetables or fruits, and make it more accessible in that sense.
What are some of the things that you were saying that grow really? What are some of those native foods that you just mentioned?
Things like so from the carbohydrate standpoint, you have sweet potatoes, taro, yam. You have jicama beans. So things that you seldom do see some of these in large amounts in the supermarket. The green leafy stuff, things like sayur manis, which is sweet vegetable, ulam raja, doang kedok, things like that. So they are things that you might find in the wet market, not in the supermarkets, but in the wet market only specific days, because the demand is not there. So they for the retailers or the stallholders, they don't bring it in very often. A lot of these food have been used in more traditional Malay cuisines, Peranakan cuisines, and so it's still not very accessible in terms of how to use it at home by many Singaporeans.
So in what ways have you been weaving that into your programs? Is that through working with chefs and restaurants, or is it through education programs that you run in your demonstration centres? And how are people responding to this?
We use different techniques in trying to create awareness around this. So what you mentioned was correct. We work with chefs a lot. I think that translation of something that is unfamiliar into something that is yummy on the plate, and providing guides of how to do that, it was something that we have worked with a lot of chefs on. So we have a community supported agriculture box scheme called the Citizen Box. And within that, there's a lot of sort of native produce in that. And we do work with chefs to then create recipe cards that goes with them. In our education programs, we talk a lot about things that people can grow at home without massive amount of intervention, for example. So it doesn't need to be in a climate controlled environment. It can grow in the very harsh tropical weather, because a lot of these plants are perennial plants. And so you don't have to reseed and resow every single time, and you can just constantly harvest from it. So we encourage people to try growing that at home, whether it's, you know, in that small little patch, because every public housing, they have at least a walkway or strip or small little corner outside of their flat where they can actually grow something depending on the amount of light. So we try and most of these spaces are low light level areas. So we try and introduce to them a lot more shade loving plants, like the pandan, like some of the gingers, for example, which, you know, thrive a bit more low light levels. Things like the Indian barrage, which has this beautiful oregano smell, do thrive in these low light level conditions. So these are easy to grow plants that will keep things interesting for them, because it's hard to fail on some of these plants. They are quite resilient. I think putting them on a route of success is, I think, the first win for us.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And ones that are really low maintenance, I think that's fantastic. And also ones that just keep giving as well. It's not like you have to keep planting and pulling and planting and pulling. And having a little bit of space. I was wondering about compost. Is there a municipal composting scheme beyond, you know, the garden waste, but the food scraps? Is that something that's starting to be collected yet, or are people doing it personally in their own garden systems?
So, unfortunately, I think at this point there isn't a national-wide program of food scrap collection for composting. Though there have been a lot of, I guess, community initiatives or civil society's initiative around composting. So I know of a couple of programs, for example, Black Gold, where they come together as a community to make compost. And this is then everyone brings their waste. They have a space in one of the one of the parks, and that's where they sort of turn their compost and create their compost. Then there have been other sort of waste to fertility initiatives around the black soldier fly. So there's quite a few black soldier fly farms in Singapore. The limitations of these black soldier fly farms is they are very particular on the type of food waste that comes in. And a lot of times it is pre-consumer food waste. So feeding them okara, which is a soybean waste, and then fermented grains, which is from the brewery process. So they do solve the food waste issue, but it's a small part. And then, what they produce is a great fertilizer, though, that goes back into the gardens. And the general sort of waste or green waste that comes out from Singapore, because we are a garden city, that there's a lot of horticulture trimmings. And in the past, there were bigger operations that do produce municipal compost. But again, with the challenge of space and land accessibility, many of these have moved overseas to Malaysia, because it's just hard to operate in Singapore because of the costs. But hopefully in near future, there will be more initiatives around this. If you look at Singapore as a organism, right, you know, the amount of food it imports, if we are able to just capture that 700,000 tons, the amount of fertility that we can produce could feed us for a long time.
Yeah, phenomenal. I'd love to hear more about some of the specifics of your programs. You've talked about, you know, you have citizen boxes and demonstration farms, education centres, and I understand too, you help to offer some sort of employment for people with disabilities, or there's also programs that are sort of lifestyle events that are encouraging community engagement, or therapeutic gardens, as well as, you know, the chef gardens. And I wonder whether there's anything with schools. Maybe if you could just kind of paint a picture of the kind of initiatives that you've been able to activate in Singapore?
Yeah, maybe I could just put it more in a timeline of how we started and how things came about, because we didn't sort of create a master plan of how we were going to approach this thing called urban farming or working within the food system. It all came in specific timelines, and we actually started by building herb gardens, and that was because it was hard to get land. And I think at that time we were given opportunities by chefs trying to grow their own food, but failed, and they had some patio space, small space in their restaurant, and setting that up for them was a very low hanging fruit. So we built one garden led to 200 gardens, but we never intended. That was never our intention to build gardens. It was always about farming. So over time, building these gardens, people started to see what was happening, and they started to offer space. And this then led towards us setting up a closed loop farm in Singapore on one of the transitionary state land. Over time, you know, we built gardens for such a diverse group of organizations, from schools to restaurants to developers to hotels. So it was always sort of mix and match. Schools were something that were always part of that ecosystem, because we were able to translate a lot of the outcomes that we wanted the students to take through the garden, through creating a living classroom, an outdoor classroom. In the early days, when we were setting up herb gardens or an urban farm in schools, the teachers would normally send the naughty kids to us, people on detention, as a form of punishment, right? You know, go work on the garden. And but we have seen that change in the last 10 years. Today, you get the top great students participating in it first. So that mindset has shifted a lot, and I'm really glad that it has.
Why do you think that shifted, and what's happened? What's happened to make that? Because that's really interesting. I think that's fascinating.
I think this is, again, sort of within over time, there have been changes in the global ecology as well. Sustainability became a more trendy subject. Singapore's government, with its commitment on producing more food, became highly publicized. So the mindset started to shift in people to understand that food production is fundamental. It's not a punishment to work in the garden. And working in the garden has therapeutic benefits as well. So it became, now it's no longer a punishment, and it's seen as a therapeutic session where you can learn and understand your natural environment. And I think this has to do with the work globally that all the ecologists, the urban agriculture enterprises, and the people in the food system to be able to drive this positive change around the world.
Yeah, that's amazing. So, shifting from being a punishment to being a pleasure out there, which is really fantastic. And I wonder too if you could just go back to that description that you used before about the closed loop farm. And what do you mean when you say closed loop? Can you just describe that a little bit more, of how that system works?
Yeah, I first came across closed loop, at least the philosophy around closed loop farming or closed loop systems, first through permaculture and then through Rudolf Steiner's work, viewing the farm as a living organism, and you know how the waste generated can be repurposed, ensuring there's minimal inputs but maximum output. And this has always been etched at the back of my mind. It is hard to apply some of the ideas that you apply on broad acre into small rooftops and urban spaces. When we came across 8,000 square meters land in the middle in urban Singapore, we thought let's give it a fair go at this. And at the time, before food waste became a trendy subject, we started the first Black Soldier Fly farm at our location, where the idea of bringing in waste, converting it to fertility, and then feeding that back into our growing system was our attempt at creating a closed loop system. It's not ideal, but it was an attempt, and we have learned a lot from that experience. Is that sometimes you just can't be a purist. You just have to let go, allow, you know, the mechanics to sort itself out. Over time, it has evolved as well into something very different today. I think within that closed loop system, we made quite a number of mistakes as well. Because if you look at closed loop, it's just not about fertility, but about resource use. And we have quite a number of indoor farms within that space, which are very high energy inputs to produce a crop of high value, which unfortunately is the only way that we are able to survive at this point. I think we try and manage the different levers to ensure that we are producing a positive outcome. So it's not calculated in terms of how much CO2 we're producing or that, but we measure social impact outcomes and also then environmental outcomes as well.
I'm really interested to hear what your thoughts are in terms of the shift. You've talked about the shift in perception in some directions, but are there younger people that you're discovering who are saying, yeah, I really want to get into urban agriculture here in Singapore? Or are there shifts in professional organizations, like you're saying, like there's the greening roof and green buildings movement, which is really huge, but are you seeing people now automatically going to think about food in the way that they're doing that? Has that dial moved, have you noticed?
Yes, the dial has moved quite a lot, especially in the last few years. I think during COVID and post-COVID actually accelerated during that time because it was very clear the supermarket shelves were not stocked. People were panic buying. That started to get people to think about food and where their food comes from and food systems and, you know, encouraging local agriculture and growing their own food. So all these were really accelerated during the pandemic and the lockdowns, which in some ways, you know, encouraged many people to think outside of the box as well. But unfortunately, I think as we get back to normalcy, people start to forget the garden beds that they have once put in when they were stuck at home are now disused. It's important to keep the momentum going through the work that we do. The whole experience for young people on the farm, well, we have many volunteer groups coming from schools, all personal volunteers use. The experience of growing a plant and harvesting it. I share with you this example of this young lady who has been working on the farm. And during harvest, you know, one or two of the vegetables fell from the box and she was like, oh, was really caring about the fallen vegetables. Like, oh, you can't waste that. You know, it's such hard work. And so then the transformation is not just about the growing process, but also educating them on the work that's required and about waste. And a lot of times the young people bring these stories or these learnings back home, sit on a dinner table, share with their parents, and kind of in some ways also change the mindset of the family and practices within that, whether they are now doing composting at home, or whether they are being a lot more aware of their food waste, whether they're growing their own food, things like that. So I think young people are a very important catalyst within the entire space of food sustainability. And we continue to reach out and work with young adults and, you know, school kids, and even, you know, kids from childcare, you know, they come to the farm as well to experience. And because of restrictions and space, we found, of course, having animals on the farm provides always that additional engagement tool with the kids, and with and of course the insects. The black soldier fly farm that we have on site creates excitement with the kids as well.
I've seen that so many times as well here in the projects I've been involved in, and how too that you really don't know how far it's going, because once it's sort of catalyzed in someone, it just keeps going and going, and I think it's phenomenal.
I think over the years, having experienced all of these and spoken to various people around the world, like you, comes back to me realizing that we are all doing the same thing. We are all the systems and the models are the same. Whether there are nuances of how we tweak it based on geographical or climate, the systems are the same, or the approaches are the same. So I think it's important that collectively, as a global community, we're able to share a lot of these learnings, failures, know-hows with each other, in a way open sourcing these learnings and ideas so that it can be adopted and adapted for all parts of the world.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, we talked about the young people. What about the older people who might remember farming and agriculture? Like, what's their response to this?
We have been focusing on the elderly population for the last 4 to 5 years. We started because we were asked to do a project for a low-income housing district in Singapore, where we started a farm called Grandfather Farm. It's called Akong Farm. And this was more adapted to a social service response, because they found that elderly males had a propensity to fall into social isolation a lot quicker, and because they don't open up to the counselors, so the farm was actually used as a tool to bring these elderly gentlemen down into a community setting. And it was really interesting. In 6 weeks, I was able to see this gentleman by the name of Mr. Lim. He came down on week one. He was looking down. He was not speaking, and very detached, right? By week six, he couldn't stop talking. He couldn't stop him talking. So that transformation within a 6 weeks period, he found a community, he found you know, solace in the plants. He told me that I have insomnia, so at night I come down to the garden to look at the garden. And so it becomes very powerful, not just as a food growing tool, but also as a community activation tool. And we continued down this path where we work with the National Parks Board and the National University of Singapore to work on the sort of more medical outcomes of horticulture therapy and care farming. And through the research, we have found actually a reduction in stress markers within the participants. And these are blood markers samples that we took prior and after the program. And these are stress markers that causes inflammation in the body. And whether you associate then the string of illnesses that comes from inflammation in the body, dementia being one of them, we were able to prove that there is a benefit from working in the garden or being close to nature, and, you know, doing something hands-on with nature could reduce this propensity of that inflammation. So So anecdotally, you know, the experiences have come up. And then medically, there are also now evidence. So we decided to really focus on this idea of converting many of these of our urban farms into care farms, not only for elderly, but I think everyone needs some sort of care, whether it's stressed out office worker, down to the stressed out school kids, or the elderly. But the farm will then form that foundation of providing care to, you know, the community, but also to then the environment and nature.
I love that concept, the care farming. It's a term that I've been starting to use, and I'm hearing it pop up in lots of different places. And I'm so curious to hear, is the research that the university doing actually using those terms, care farm, in the work that they're doing? Is there documented research about this? I would love to tap into it.
Currently not in Singapore, but in countries such as the UK, in Netherlands, care farming is a well-established concept, whether it's green care, and there are many terms for it. And so it's still something quite new in Singapore. And with a lot of these sort of more linked to medical research, we need to do a lot more studies. So we are working with the National University of Singapore, the School of Public Health, to institute a study of 200 elderly patients or participants that come into a farm to do a program on farming, and then to measure, again, the blood marker samples. I think to increase the sample size allow us to collect a lot more data. We hope that, you know, in future, that if you go to a hospital or a clinic and share that you have a bit of depression or, you know, just feeling a bit down mentally, instead of prescribing the person a antidepressant, prescribe him or her a course in urban farming at your local community farm. I think that will be one of the best outcomes that we hope for.
Yeah. And just finally, too, you're currently doing doctoral research on food sovereignty and indigenous food systems in Singapore. I wonder whether you might just be able to speak a little bit about the direction that you're taking that research.
For me, it was more a realization down the track that a lot of the work that we were doing was, again, in the natural ecosystem. And the plants that we were using were indigenous and native plants. And it was only when I was doing my research, my doctoral research, and being based in Victoria, and then having engaged with the indigenous community, First Nations community here in Hillsville at Coranda, was when I started to realize that, hey, you know, I've been using all this knowledge to create these gardens, but I've never for once thought about where those knowledge have come from. And of course, then making money from it and not then paying my due respect or referencing in that sense. So then that got me to look into that and starting to understand the history of the indigenous community in Singapore, which are the Orang Lauts or the Orang Pulaus. They are seafaring communities. They fish, they forage for their food, and they live always in harmony with the environment because they rely on the environment for sustenance. And during the development of Singapore, many of them, actually all of them, were displaced from their traditional homes, from the islands, into mainland, put into high-rise buildings. And I think the challenge with the modernization of Singapore is that these practices that they once were doing, they are not able to continue. Today, foraging in Singapore brings you a hefty fine or jail term. So these considerations is what we're starting to look at, and how we can actually bring a bit more awareness around indigenous rights around some of these practices.
I want to ask you, sorry, about the foraging piece that you just said. Foraging can bring you a jail term. Foraging what? What could possibly land you in jail to forage?
So because of again, a very top-down approach in governance in Singapore, all land in Singapore is owned by the government in some sense or another. So state parks or green corridors around Singapore, they are considered state land. So if you pluck something from that, it's breaking the law. But this is everywhere in Singapore. So if you're foraging from nature, from a forest, you are encroaching on state property in that sense.
Are there state gardeners that are foraging and harvesting the food that's grown in the public places and doing something with it instead?
So again, it's a blanket law. They have used that a few times to incriminate people. Because I don't know if you know of this fruit, durian. Durian. So there are wild durian trees in Singapore, and because it's such a delicacy, people will, find those trees out. In a way, it's a deterrent for people stripping, state forests or nature reserve, again without consideration of practices of the native people. So perhaps, hopefully, through food discourses with the Orang Laut community. To get them to understand the history and the culture and the practices, we can slowly change the mindset of policymakers to actually recognize this.
Yeah, that's amazing work. So how far are you into your doctoral research? Are you almost there?
Yes and no. I wish it was over. But I think what we will do at this forum, because you will hear from Firdaus, from the Orang Laut, who will fly into Sydney to share his story. And I think this will allow also for the Indigenous community in Singapore to build links with the First Nation community here to learn on how to communicate, his cause to the government in Singapore. I think will be a really good exchange. So I'm really looking forward to his sharing as well.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really look forward to meeting you at the Urban Agriculture Forum in Sydney coming up. For everyone who's listening, this podcast is part of the Urban Agriculture Month, which is hosted by Sustain Australia. And both Bjorn and I will be there with many other urban agriculture folk from around Australia and beyond exploring these themes. So I'm sure that the materials that come out of that forum, if you're not able to get there, will be made available so that you can access them as well. So thank you so much for joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure to hear about the work that you've been doing for a long time in Singapore and to really understand the dynamics of urban food systems from the context of your country. It's absolutely fascinating. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Sense Making in a Changing World. Check out the show notes below to find the links to Bjorn's project and the Urban Agriculture Month activities. Also, check out the notes for where to find details of our permaculture courses, our YouTube, blog, free masterclasses, and film club. Make sure you're signed up to hear the news and updates and come and join us at the Permaculture Education Institute to learn practical skills for designing and teaching permaculture and actually making a good livelihood doing it while living a permaculture-inspired one planet way of life. Thanks for joining me. Take care. See you soon.